to the podcast, episode 74, after something of a hiatus. It's been a while since we've been here at the round table, and I say we, I should say I. I'm flying solo now, and more or less steering the ship as I did before, so we'll see how it goes. We've got lots to talk about here, so welcome back. This segment is called The End of an Era, and I'm referring here to Honest Ed's, which closed its doors at the corner of Bathurst and Bloor Streets for the final time on December 31st, 2016. That marks the end of 68 years in business. Honest Ed's was established in 1948 by Ed Mervish, who was born July 24th, 1914 as Yehuda Mervish and changed his name to Ed. And of course, he died at age 92 in 2007, as Torontonians will recall. The world's changed a bit over those years, but for those 68 years, Honest Ed's was a Toronto landmark. When his father died, Ed Mervish dropped out of school to take over the family store on Dundas Street West. And the store, when it finally opened, that is to say, Honest Ed's, stock turned over every 2 weeks, so every item needed a sign. Ed hired a sign painter to do that. And over the past months, those trademark signs have been bought up by the hundreds as souvenirs, memorabilia. Ed Mervish subversively plied all the gimmicks of retail. Loss leaders, discount pricing, celebrities, PR stunts. And then there was that massive Honest Ed sign, 23,000 light bulbs in total. That wasn't on the original 1948 building. It came later, in fact, some decades later, in the 1970s. Interestingly enough, Honest Ed's peaked in 1990. Around that time, they were offered an opportunity by Loblaws to open a store in each of the grocer's locations, but Ed declined. He had no appetite for expansion of that sort. And he didn't want stockholders or partners or anything like that. He wanted to run the store his way as he saw fit. He wanted to be able to keep it small enough that he could have familiarity with his customers, get to know them, get to know their likes and dislikes, and do it his way. That was his personality. Well, the store went into a 25-year decline after 1990 in the era of Walmart and Amazon. Honest Ed's was an anachronism, and that's probably why some people liked it. But times changed, and now that Honest Ed's is gone, the change will accelerate. Mervish Village, the area as it's known, will become something entirely different now. Yes, the store was garish, its decline was apparent. Something new, something modern, something expensive is surely on the way. Something too expensive for most of us here in Toronto. In my city, the days of discounts and bargains are over. In December of 2016, December 22nd, that was the day Robert Yago, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, lit a firestorm on Twitter. Here's how it happened in his own words. I'm reading from a December 24th APTN editorial titled, Why I Question Joseph Boyden's Indigenous Ancestry. I've had to cut out some of his comments from this piece, but you can look up the full editorial at APTN's website. So here's the quote. 2 days ago, I was given the opportunity to guest host at the Twitter account Indigenous Extra. It's a shared account that each week is hosted by a different First Nations person. It's a larger and more influential audience than I'm used to, and I chose to use it to bring out into the open what a lot of us natives have been saying about Joseph Boyden privately, that we question his native identity. What led many of us to think this is that the way in which Boyden has described his indigenous background is confused. What brought me to him and the issue of his identity was a tweet by Margaret Atwood in late November. That tweet, bestowing indigeneity on former UBC professor Stephen Galloway, was part of her response to the controversy surrounding the letter that Boyden, a former UBC instructor, wrote in Galloway's defense. Galloway was fired after an investigation by UBC over claims of sexual impropriety. I found that tweet to be literally shout at the screen enraging, in part because of the low regard it showed for First Nations people. Was he assuming that we would overlook sexual harassment because the accused was one of us? But more because Joseph Boyden seemed to have given himself the right to hand out Indigenous identity to whomever he pleases, instead of treating it as a valuable inheritance that our parents and grandparents suffered and fought to maintain, Boyden trivialized it and cheapened it. End of quote. So there's a lot in there. For example, the Stephen Galloway affair, the firing of a UBC professor over alleged sexual harassment. That's one of the things going on in this piece. Another is that Joseph Boyden came to his defense in the form of a letter signed by numerous luminaries of Canadian literature, Margaret Atwood among them, and we don't really have time to get into that. This is really about a discussion that has been going on for weeks now. Jorge Barrera reported for APTN. Articles were published in Canadian media, Globe and Mail, the Toronto Star, Maclean's. Many, many people have weighed in, both Indigenous and otherwise. Wob Canoe, Jordan Wheeler, Lee Miracle, DJ Indian, and I'm going to close with a quotation from him. They've all spoken publicly about Joseph Boyden. When Robert Yago did some digging up last December, he confirmed what many of us had already noticed, and he alludes to this, of course, in the piece that I've just read. And what we've noticed is that Joseph Boyden has no evident connection to any Indigenous community of any kind, but he's widely revered in Canada as a voice of Aboriginal people, perhaps the voice, certainly a prominent one. He's the go-to guy for Canadian journalists who need a quick quote, an interview, or a panel member. And that's the root of the problem, in my estimation. Canadians want an easy, convenient, one-stop shopping. They want a nice Indian, a good Indian, an Indigenous person who looks and sounds and thinks like they do. And in this case, that just happens to be Joseph Boyden. Now, don't get me wrong here. He's a talented writer. I imagine if I met him, he'd behave like a decent guy. And he must be having a hard time right now. And I don't much relish this occasion to put him under a spotlight. But he is a spotlight guy. We should expect to be held accountable for what we write and what we say in public. So fair game. Over the years, Joseph Boyden has described himself as many different things. Métis, Ojibwe, Mi'kmaq, the list goes on. Over the years, he's had many stories recounting many types of Indigenous identity. Well, it sure looks to me like he's none of those things, and it always has. Whenever I've heard him speak, he's struck me as an unremarkable, middle-of-the-road, conventional Canadian liberal. His message is, let's all get along. And there's nothing wrong with that message, but I notice he tends to say we when he means Canada and Canadians, and he says they when he means Indigenous people. It's a detail, but it's an odd detail, and it jumped out at me right away when I first encountered him. I always notice that, and I notice lots of real Indigenous people identify as Canadian. In other words, there's nothing unusual about him speaking that way. I just happen to have noticed it. There are Indigenous people who don't identify as Canadian, many of them. They belong to sovereign nations, an unceded territory in some cases. They don't recognize the legitimacy of Canada's claims to their land, to their resources, to their identities. They challenge the notion that Canada and Canadians, under federal law, have the right to decide who is an Indian using the Indian Act's racist blood quantum system. Have you ever noticed these Indigenous people, the ones who challenge Canada's prerogatives, never get to be that official spokesperson, that gatekeeper, that passageway into the Indigenous experience? It's true, I'm an old guy, I've been around, And I know, you'll never get an Order of Canada in this country by saying Indigenous people have their own laws and their own rights to govern themselves. But then again, people who say that don't want an Order of Canada either. They get their validation from their own people. Now, what is this to do with Boyden? In some ways, it's obvious, but in others, less so. Non-Indigenous writers predictably came to Boyden's defense, exercising their right as settlers and colonists to decide who their real Indigenous people are. They're one-stop shopping arbiters of the Aboriginal experience, as if there ever could be such a thing. It's a ridiculous notion, the Indigenous experience. The mass media editorials accused people like Robert Yago of conducting an inquisition, a DNA lynch mob. Yes, one of the writers used the term lynching. It was a perfect illustration of the very thing we Indigenous people were critiquing in the first place, the assumed and presumed Canadian right to decide who will speak for us, the assumed and presumed Canadian right to decide what sorts of words and ideas will be consumed, will be acceptable, as well as what is beyond the pale. The assumed and presumed Canadian right to dictate and legislate and circumscribe every aspect of Indigenous life, right down to the question even of who is an Indigenous person. A lot of for real Indigenous people aren't recognized by the government as such. Think about it. They have kin and clans. They belong to a community. They're connected. But Canada will never give them a status card because of the bizarre world of Indian affairs has some bizarre rules about who qualifies as an Indigenous person. Others have lost connections to their people as a result of residential schools and forced adoptions by the state. I've met many of these people over the year, and their stories are heartbreaking. They have connections too. Yes, Canada has fractured those connections of family and clan and nation, but it is possible to go home. This is my message to everyone in Canada. There are enough real Indigenous people trying to find their way home. This is our struggle, our conversation, our experiences, and yes, experiences plural. There is not one Indigenous experience. It's great if you found someone who Indian whispers to you, but in the end, our communities do get to decide who their people are. We get to decide how we will govern ourselves. We have to, and we will. So to close, I'm going to read you a brief posting by Ian Campo, otherwise known as DJ Indian, from a tribe called Red. And I quote, "I'm going to put in my 2 cents on the Joseph Boyden thing. The problem here is accountability, not race. My dad was 100%, quote, white. He was also Anishinaabe. He was accepted as such by my family and my community of Garden Village of Nipissing First Nation. He was given the name Gnu Nimi, Golden Eagle Man, and given ceremonies of passage by respected elders and community leaders. He was accountable to my family and my community because they claimed him. Nobody's claimed Joseph. There's no accountability right now. He told me to my face that his uncle, Injun Joe, was his connection. I believed him. His accountability to being Anishinaabe turned out to be false. Therefore, he's left unaccountable. We're too hurt to have unaccountable people talking for us. If a community claims Joseph, then he has people to be held accountable to. This could be easily resolved if Joseph told us who told him he was Native. Then there would be some sort of accountability. Until then, he can't speak for a community. This is how I feel." Have you ever considered wearing white in winter? Maybe you already do. Over 100 years ago, Mark Twain wrote a passage in his autobiography about his desire to work up enough courage to wear white all winter long. It's a lovely little passage speaking to our universal fears and self-limitations, our deference, our need to fit in, to avoid causing affront. We tend not to think of Twain this way. He's a writer who says what no one else will or can. In his life, he took bold and unconventional positions, satirizing human folly, ridiculing religion, and denouncing American imperialism, to cite just three examples. You'd think Mark Twain would dress as he wrote, as a devil may care, do as he please. Well, here's Mark Twain on wearing white in winter. Next, after fine colors, I like plain white. One of my sorrows when the summer ends is that I must put off my cheery and comfortable white clothes and enter for the winter into the depressing captivity of the shapeless and degrading black ones. It is mid-October now, and the weather is growing cold up here in the New Hampshire hills, but it will not succeed in freezing me out of these white garments, for here the neighbors are few, and it is only of crowds that I am afraid. I made a brave experiment the other night to see how it would feel to shock a crowd with these unseasonable clothes, and also to see how long it might take the crowd to reconcile itself to them and stop looking astonished and outraged. On a stormy evening, I made a talk before a full house in the village, clothed like a ghost, and looking as conspicuous, all solitary and alone on that platform, as any ghost could have looked. And I found, to my gratification, that it took the house less than 10 minutes to forget about the ghost and give its attention to the tidings I had brought. I am nearly 71, and I recognize that my age has given me a good many privileges, valuable privileges, privileges which are not granted to younger persons. Little by little, I hope to get together courage enough to wear white clothes all through the winter in New York. It will be a great satisfaction to me to show off in this way, and perhaps the largest of all the satisfactions will be the knowledge that every scoffer of my sex will secretly envy me and wish he had dared to follow my lead. Mr. Triple Speak. It is a bright winter day in the city. The sky is a radiant blue. Few are the clouds. The birds sing in the trees, high above the commerce of the city. Good evening, says Mr. Triple Speak to all whom he encounters. It's a lovely night, is it not? A lovely night, they reply. A good evening. Can't you see it is day? The thing is as plain as the nose on your face. How dare you say, I have a nose, blurts Mr. Triple Speak. His face blooms an angry burst of orange. I have no such thing, he says. And anyways, I never said it was evening, much less night. You misrepresent me. But you did say so, the people reply, more confused than injured. You said good evening. You said it is a lovely night. Well, it is a lovely night, but I did not say so, says Mr. Triplespeak, as he dashes away. Everywhere Mr. Triplespeak goes, the scene unfolds. Did you know your neighbor is a cannibal? He says to a woman at the deli. To a man in the grocery store, he says, trust nothing you read in the papers. Mr. Triplespeak seems eccentric. His manner of speaking strikes all as ridiculous. When his name comes up in conversation, everyone laughs. Ha ha! Mr. Triplespeak, what an absurd, bumbling fellow, unable to tell up from down, night from day, and truth from lies. Yes, they all laugh at Mr. Triplespeak, for a while. And then something curious happens. One day Mr. Triplespeak meets a fellow in the street. To the fellow he says, there are mysterious rays in the air that cause blindness. The rays come from atop the hill at the center of our city. And the fellow replies, "I've always suspected it." The two of them go about their business together. Now they are friends, and the people of their city laugh at them in their absence. Time passes, and Mr. Triplespeak makes many acquaintances who concur with his silly ideas. He still seems harmless enough to his neighbors, who laugh when his name comes up in conversation. One day Mr. Triplespeak runs for mayor, and the people laugh at his outlandish proposals. "Our city has been ruined by invisible unicorn fairies," shouts Mr. Triplespeak from the podium. "Our mayor is an alien from outer space. We must be rid of him," Mr. Triplespeak shouts. "He is not one of us." The people are shocked. They begin to wonder if Mr. Triplespeak has intentions of malice. By this time, Mr. Triplespeak has a tribe numbering the thousands. "Good evening," says Mr. Triplespeak to his followers, and although it is day, his followers reply, "Good evening, dear leader," with enthusiasm. Anyone with the temerity to suggest that it is in fact day is immediately known to belong to the other tribe, the enemy tribe, the ones who must be vanquished. Mr. Triplespeak is elected mayor. He stands before the camera. "Today, our city is the greatest city in the world, and all our problems have been solved by my election," he says. "All problems, except for one. The only real problem, the problem of those who say it is day when I say it is night, and night when I say it is day." His followers cheer. "This is exactly the problem," they say. "By God, he's put his finger on it. That is the problem, the very root of our discontent, the thing we have failed to see all along." If you'd asked me even a year ago about the intelligence services, I would have agreed with you if you'd said it was time for an overhaul. The services are massive bureaucracies. In the past, they have failed spectacularly. Sure, it's a convention on Capitol Hill to praise the so-called intelligence community, to laud their heroism and bravery, their invaluable service to the country. I'm not saying there's nothing but hot air to all of this, but it is a convention. Americans don't know how much the intelligence services even spend, and on what, and with what results. As government bureaucracies go, it's a whopper. Why not review and streamline it? Sounds like a good idea. Well, here's the Wall Street Journal, and I quote, "President-elect Donald Trump, a harsh critic of U.S. intelligence agencies, is working with top advisors on a plan that would restructure and pare back the nation's top spy agency," people familiar with the planning said. "The move is prompted by his belief that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence has become bloated and politicized," these people said. End of quote. Well, I don't feel the same way now that I know it's Donald Trump who'll be giving the orders. He's got some questionable dealings going on with Russia. He says the intelligence community is politicized, and he's right. He's been politicizing them. It's clear he has an agenda. He doesn't like what the CIA and the FBI are saying. Something is happening, folks. And yes, there are many, many things to be concerned about right now as we approach the Trump inaugural. But this is a big one, a very big one. What's going on with Trump and Russia? What is the president-elect's agenda? And what is he hiding? And what does he know that we don't know? What's in store for all of us? There are so many urgent questions. And the president-elect says we should just move on. time for some Drew reviews. And in Drew's reviews this week, Drew reviews money.
Do, 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 do. Drew's Reviews. Hey guys, it's Drew from Drew's Reviews. And today, I've got money. You probably look at this and say, let's fast forward and just get to the number. But look, think about it. This is so easy. You just take it. $1. You take it, $1. You go, you get, if it's an item, you get three of these. And you start, right? And you say, well, that's going to be bulky. Look at that. Five. So instead of a stack, you've got five. And then six. And then when you, if you need 1,100, you get more. You get more money, and if you get, if you need 50 trillion, that's right, 50, it's got all the zeros, and this is, if you take the fives, and you would say, well, I need 1 trillion, one, then, it's like the Mac. The Mac of money, the Apple, it's so thin. So thanks Steve Jobs, and I rate money 8 out of 10, and it kicks ass.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week.